Well, last time we started the chapter, just barely, by talking about adenosine triphosphate, which you can kind of think of as the goal in this overall process that we're starting to look at, which is the oxidation of glucose. Now, other fuels exist besides glucose, but glucose is the master fuel, so that's what we're going to concentrate on. In any case, when you use a fuel, what you're trying to do is get useful energy out of that. But like I said last time, you don't use that energy directly to power the endergonic processes that you're trying to accomplish. You don't use the food energy directly to do the work. Instead, you temporarily invest that usable energy in the form of ATP, which then directly can provide that energy to do the work. So ATP is a middleman in a sense. And ATP wouldn't really be so useful a molecule if it were a very stable molecule. If it were a very stable molecule, then you would end up making it and it would stay that way. It has to be able to go back and forth between ATP and ADP readily. That's the whole reason that it's so versatile as an energy-carrying molecule. Because after being phosphorylated into ATP, it can then readily become dephosphorylated into ADP, releasing the energy that it temporarily stored. And so there are a few reasons why ATP is an unstable molecule, some of which is pictured here in slide 2. We're not looking at ATP on the top. We're looking at a carboxyl group. But the point here is that there is resonance in certain molecules, right? You understand what resonance refers to? Resonance is delocalization of electrons. So even though a carboxyl group is typically written as you see in the upper left, that's not really how it exists in reality. There isn't a double bond just with one of the oxygens that's always a double bond, and a single bond with the other oxygen that's always a single bond. Instead, each one of them is a bond and a half, more or less, because there is delocalization of electrons around all three of those nuclei, the carbon and the two oxygens, represented by the blue dash there. This gives that group greater stability. Okay, so if you consider a phosphate group, which is, of course, the business end of the ATP molecule, a phosphate group also has resonance stabilization when it's on its own. When it's an inorganic phosphate, it has its maximum resonance stability, which you can see right here. This is an inorganic phosphate, right? And so those electrons can be maximally delocalized, which gives that phosphate greater stability. When you hook a phosphate onto something else, like you do when you take an inorganic phosphate and put it onto an ADP molecule to make ATP, then that doesn't allow for as much resonance stability. In other words, you've resulted in a little bit of instability by putting that extra phosphate on. Okay? And that's one reason why ATP has instability. Another is that phosphate groups are negatively charged. And when you put them together, you're trying to force like charges to be near each other. So there's charge repulsion between adjacent phosphates. And if you break that bond and allow them to repel each other, that makes it more stable. So they're less stable when they're incorporated into the ATP molecule. And then the third reason is simply that when you, in general, break a big molecule down into smaller pieces, you increase stability because you give those individual pieces more freedom than they would be, than they would have by having to be part of a bigger chunk. In other words, you increase the randomness if you allow them all on their own. They can occupy space more freely when they're on their own. So, in general, breaking something down into smaller chunks is going to have that's going to feature an increase in entropy, an increase in disorder, and therefore become more stable. So, all three of those things, resonance stabilization, charge repulsion, and entropy increase, all favor the loss of that phosphate from ATP to make it ADP, an inorganic phosphate. And that's why it readily will do that. Well, ATP is just one of several phosphorylated molecules, of course. Phosphates get shuttled around all the time. And in slide 3, we can see, not by any means an exhaustive list of phosphorylated molecules, but several important players in the game. And these are, notice, ordered by their value of delta G naught prime. Here, that delta G value is known as the standard free energy of hydrolysis, meaning if this phosphorylated thing, whatever it is in the list, becomes dephosphorylated, if you use a hydrolysis reaction to break that bond and take and liberate that phosphate from the main molecule, that will liberate a certain amount of energy that is the value of delta G. Notice they're all negatives because it becomes more stable for reasons I just discussed when you get rid of that phosphate. All right? The magnitude of it, though, the absolute value of it, in other words, how negative it is, gives you an indication of just how unstable it is when it's phosphorylated. And therefore, it gives you an idea of how willing, in a sense, it is to give that phosphate up to something else. And so these things are ordered by what we call phosphoryl transfer potentials. A phosphoryl transfer potential is this willingness for a phosphorylated species to give that phosphate up to something else, to transfer its phosphoryl group, in other words. Well, notice that ATP is in this list, and it's about midway in this list. So there are certain things that ATP wouldn't be a candidate for phosphorylating, namely the things above it in the list, because that would be a positive delta G to go up in the list. On the other hand, the things that are above ATP in the list can give their phosphate up to ADP to make it ATP. Okay? So anything on the list can phosphorylate anything below it on the list, is the point. But not upward. ATP can be phosphorylated, for instance, by phosphoenolpyruvate. But ATP can phosphorylate anything below it on the list. And that's because this thing is ordered by the value of the phosphoryl transfer potential. Well, we can see this in more of a picture form in slide 4. The Y value of this graph is, as you see, delta G naught prime, the values that we were just looking at. And notice it's ordered by, it goes up as it gets more negative, which is unusual for a graph, but notice that. So phosphoenolpyruvate, which we just saw in the last slide, was at the top of the list. It has the highest of all those ones that were listed, the highest negative value for delta G naught prime. That has the highest phosphoryl transfer potential of all those things listed in that previous table. And that's why it's able to, as you see here, give up its phosphate to ADP, phosphorylating that ADP into ATP. ATP was below it in the list. And then ATP can give up its phosphate to something with an even lower phosphoryl transfer potential, in this case, glucose, to make it glucose-6-phosphate. Which is exactly what you do with your own glucoses as soon as they come into your cell. You phosphorylate that glucose at the expense of an ATP as a source of that phosphate. You turn it into glucose-6-phosphate. Anyone know why you do that? There's a couple reasons. Well, for one thing, glucose-6-phosphate is no longer glucose. It's a different chemical. And so, if you're bringing in glucose because of a gradient, the more that happens, the more the gradient dissipates, right? But if you immediately upon entry into the cell turn it into something else, then you still have that gradient for glucose in place because glucose is no longer there, right? Effectively, when you phosphorylate it. It also locks it in the cell so that it can't escape back out by diffusion. But anyway, it's able to pick up that phosphate from ATP because it has a lower phosphoryl transfer potential. Okay, so let's go to 5 and think about this in the broadest terms of why you actually do what you do with your food. Your food contains not only raw materials for building molecules, but also it contains fuel molecules, which are defined as fuel simply because they are what you obtain the energy from for your various endergonic processes. And the way that you exploit a fuel energetically, chemically speaking, what you're doing is oxidizing it, right? That's what you do to your fuels to make them useful molecules energetically, is that you oxidize them. So fuels, not just glucose, fuels in general undergo redox reactions as part of biochemical pathways that are specifically catabolic pathways, right? When you oxidize your fuels, like I've said before, what you're really doing is dismantling the carbon skeletons that those fuels have originally and picking off the hydrogens that are connected to that carbon skeleton. Well, oxidation is defined as what? The loss of electrons, right? That can be nothing but electrons being removed. But there are other things that qualify as oxidation as well. When you pick off a hydrogen atom, you're removing an electron that's part of that hydrogen. You're removing a proton as well, but that still qualifies as oxidation. And so catabolism here is the whole set of reactions that are not just what we're studying in this chapter, but also the next chapter. They include glycolysis, and they include, after that, cellular respiration. Now, not every step in those two major pathways is oxidation, but overall, they are oxidative pathways, biochemical pathways. And therefore, they liberate a lot of the energy that's in those fuel molecules to begin with. Well, the blue arrows are here are indicating in another way what I've already told you a couple times, namely that you don't use that release of energy from your food molecules directly to do the cellular work. Instead, you invest that energy in ATP as the middleman. So ATP, as I said, does not last very long. Just about as quickly as it's made, it gets turned back down into ATP and inorganic phosphate. But the payoff here is that release of energy that is in ATP but used to be in the food molecule can do any one of the major kinds of cellular work that we already talked about. The ones that are in the ecru boxes on the right. Notice heat, though, is not in a shaded box. And that's because heat is not really work. Heat is really just low-grade energy that can't do any work for you. It's, in a sense, waste heat, right? Doesn't mean, though, that it's completely invaluable to you. Because the heat that you generate from your energy transactions is actually what keeps you as a homeotherm at a temperature that is usually above whatever the ambient temperature is. But it's not classified as work. And, you know, when you don't need to heat your body up, when you actually have to cool it, there's still nothing you can do about that heat being produced. Right? So you don't get to choose to turn off the heat. That just comes from the fact that there's no getting around the laws of thermodynamics, right? Any energy transaction is at least partially inefficient. And that's why you can't do anything about the heat. So you don't get as much energy out of the ATP molecule as was in, or as was released in the fuel molecule that you oxidized originally. The middleman takes a cut, in other words, in a sense. And that cut is the heat that you can't do anything but lose. All right. Well, ATP, this is slide 6. ATP is, because it has such high versatility energetically, that's what you can kind of think of as the goal for this overall oxidation of fuel, including glycolysis and cellular respiration. You have all kinds of work you need to get done. Therefore, the best thing to do is make as many ATP molecules as possible from the energy that you got by oxidizing your fuels. That's the reason that you undergo both of these processes in succession, glycolysis first and cellular respiration, if it's possible to do both. ATP, though, is not the only energy-carrying molecule involved in these processes. There's another major player, which is the subject of this slide. And we're looking at NAD, of course. What does NAD stand for? Nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. All right? And it's an example of a coenzyme. But this coenzyme really has a job energetically that's very similar to a taxi. Because its job is to pick up electrons that have been stripped from fuel and therefore we're involved in oxidation reactions, right? Because that's what stripping electrons means, oxidation. Anyway, the electrons get stripped from fuel molecules, glucose originally, but then it goes through all kinds of intermediates that also get stripped of their electrons. Those electrons get added to nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide like passengers in a taxi. The NAD is storing energy just like ATP does, but it's not as versatile a molecule. And so its job is just to drop those passengers, those electrons, off to something else with the ultimate goal of putting as much of that energy that they're carrying into the form of ATP, additional ATP molecules. Okay? Now, we're not studying cellular respiration in this chapter. NAD is involved in cellular respiration, and ATP is obviously produced as well. We're studying glycolysis in this chapter. Well, ATP is produced by glycolysis, and NAD is involved in glycolysis as well. So both of the major biochemical pathways that together make up the overall oxidation of the complete oxidation of glucose involve these two major energy-carrying molecules, ATP and NAD. So let's think back to the name. It's nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. So its surname, dinucleotide, tells you what kind of thing this is. A dinucleotide, as you would expect, is two nucleotides, right? Just like RNA is a polynucleotide, because there's many nucleotides sewn together, a dinucleotide is two. So remember what a single nucleotide contains, three components, right? A pentose sugar, to which two things at different places are attached. A nitrogenous base on one side and a phosphate group on the other side. Well, on the bottom we have those three components. Ribose, adenine, and a phosphate. What would we call this? These three things just by themselves? It is a nucleotide, but what specifically is it? Adenosine monophosphate, exactly. Adenosine is the nucleoside, in other words, just adenine and ribose. When you add a phosphate, you have adenosine monophosphate, which is a nucleotide. All right, so that's one nucleotide. Above it, you also have ribose. And instead of using one of the four RNA nitrogenous bases, uracil, adenine, guanine, and cytosine, you use a different nitrogenous base. It's not to say that those five that you study are the only five nitrogenous bases. There's all kinds of nitrogenous bases. Well, nicotinamide is just another nitrogenous base. All right? So here is the other nucleotide. And therefore, the overall name is nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. It's a dinucleotide because the two phosphates are what are sewn together with a pyrophosphate bridge. Remember that pyrophosphate is the name for two phosphates stuck directly together? So the connection between these nucleotides is different from what you see in RNA or DNA, but it still is a dinucleotide. Okay, now this whole thing, it looks fairly complex, but the business end of the molecule, what really makes it work as a taxi, is just the nicotinamide part, which is why it's in a box by itself. And NAD overall exists in two different forms, an oxidized form and a reduced form. So notice the double arrow, the reversible reaction here. It's only showing you the change that occurs in nicotinamide. The rest of the molecule is still here. They just didn't draw it again. So the only thing changing when you go back and forth between oxidized and reduced forms of NAD is the nicotinamide nitrogenous base. Okay, so it's really important to remember in energetic terms, which is the more energetic version, the oxidized or the reduced form? The reduced form, right. Why is it more energetic? Because it has those electrons. By virtue of being reduced, by definition, it has additional electrons, right? Well, those electrons are carrying energy that used to be in the fuel. Now they're in this coenzyme. So in terms of taxis, the full taxi, the one that is carrying the passengers, is the reduced form. All right. Now notice that the oxidized form is symbolized as NAD+. So that would be an empty taxi, a taxi that's able to pick up passengers. Well, anyway, it's NAD+, so it is positively charged when it's in its oxidized form. And most books, or many books at least, will list the reduced form as NADH and H+, not just NADH. It'll list it as NADH plus H+. In other words, NADH, which is the reduced form, plus a proton. Here's why. When you oxidize the fuels, often what you're doing specifically is dehydrogenation. Right? Dehydrogenation is that stripping of hydrogen atoms from the fuel. And typically that occurs as two hydrogens being stripped from the fuel. So think about two hydrogen atoms in terms of subatomic particles. What is a hydrogen atom in terms of subatomic particles? It's not a proton. A proton is a hydrogen ion. Proton and an electron. So if you take two hydrogen atoms off of a fuel molecule, what you're really taking are two electrons and two protons. Okay? NAD+, the empty taxi, has a positive charge. If you take one of those two electrons you've taken from the fuel and stick it on there, that neutralizes the charge, right? And that would make it NAD without a plus. You still have another electron and you have two protons. If you take the electron and a proton, which is a hydrogen atom, and add that, now you have NADH. But that leaves still one proton from that second hydrogen atom. And that's why it's there for accounting purposes. It's not really part of the NAD molecule. It's just in solution, but it came from the fuel. So you should still think of it in your accounting of all the atoms, all the particles. So that's why we write the oxidized form as NAD+, and the reduced form as NADH plus H+, an additional proton. Well, not only is the reduced form, NADH in other words, carrying more energy than the oxidized form, and that energy came from the fuel, but the energy that is being carried around by NADH is actually more than the energy that's being carried around by ATP. So you always have to keep in mind that if you have NADHs, you have energy that can be converted into ATP molecules. There's so much energy being carried around by NADH that there's enough to actually produce multiple ATP molecules from that one NADH. So, really important player in the game, because it will temporarily store, just for the duration of these biochemical pathways, NADH will store a lot of the energy that was originally in the fuel, and that eventually will be used to make as many ATPs as possible. Okay, now we can talk about glycolysis. And glycolysis, we're on slide 7. Glycolysis is not part of cellular respiration. Cellular respiration is really the stuff that happens after glycolysis. It starts where glycolysis ends. glycolysis is not respiration, because respiration, of which there are multiple varieties, respiration requires or involves the pumping of protons through a membrane to establish an electrochemical gradient. And we've already established that gradients can do some work for you, right? So that's the real utility of respiration, and is the fact that you establish a gradient that can do some work for you, and in this case, the work of producing ATP. Well, that's not what we're looking at in glycolysis. Glycolysis is not respiration. It's a biochemical pathway that precedes respiration. And what it means linguistically is splitting of sugar, right? Glyco refers to sugar. It's glycolysis, splitting of sugar. Now, this is a biochemical pathway, and there are 10 steps to it. You start out with glucose, and you end up with pyruvate. But that's not a direct transition. It's a stepwise transition, which is why I say it's a biochemical pathway. It's not just a reaction. It's not a single reaction. Well, this book chooses to describe glycolysis as happening in three major phases. But usually we think of it as two major phases, because there is what is first called, happening first, there is a phase called the energy investment phase. And then that's followed by an energy payoff phase. And it makes sense to just split it into these two major phases, at least primarily, because there's such an energetic fundamental difference, right? The energy investment phase is so named because even though you're trying to make ATP, you actually have to spend some ATP first in order for the glycolytic pathway or glycolysis to be able to move on. So it's like the old adage that you have to spend money to make money, right? Only in energetic terms. You first have to use some ATP to get phosphate onto the fuel, which can then be moved around in such a way that eventually you can get it back off of the fuel and produce ATP in the end. Okay, so phase one here that this book is using, preparation and cleavage, that is the energy investment phase. Phase two, the energy payoff phase, which I'm saying is the second of two major phases, that is actually B and C together in this book. So there's two, and the reason they use three phases is because there's two ways that you're paying off energetically in glycolysis. One is by oxidation of the fuel, which produces ATP. But also you have ATP formed just by rearrangement of that molecule. Okay? And that's when you end up with the final product, just the final product of just glycolysis, which is pyruvate. But notice, even though there is ATP produced in both of these stages, what's different about the oxidation phase is that in addition to making ATP, that oxidation, which is the stripping of the hydrogens from the fuel, allows you to put those onto NAD+ and reduce NAD+ into NADH. Okay? So you pay off in two ways. You make some ATP, and you make some NADH. The NADH, like I said, is carrying multiple ATPs worth of energy. It's just not yet in that ATP form. The ATP is ready to go. It's the goal, in a sense. So the ATP that's produced by glycolysis doesn't have to go through any other processing. It's the stuff that you want to make in this overall breakdown of the fuel to begin with. So ATP doesn't get sent to a downstream process, cellular respiration. It's ready to go. Cellular respiration is going to make much more ATP in its own right. But ATP is ATP. You're done with it at that point. You've stored the energy successfully into a versatile molecule, and it can do some work for you. The NADH, storing important energy, but it has to be processed first in order for it to be in a versatile ATP form. Okay? And this is a major reason why there is so much ATP produced in cellular respiration later, is because it uses the energy that's being carried by NADH. All right? So glycolysis produces both ATP and NADH. Well, it's going to produce a net amount of ATP, because even though you need to spend a couple ATPs for every glucose that you start out with in the energy investment phase, you're going to spit out 4 by the time you get through the rest of the overall glycolytic pathway. In the energy payoff phase, you end up making 4 for every glucose that enters. So 2 of those just get you back to even, because you spent 2 to enter, but then you earn 2. So you have to spend 2 ATP to make 4. That in itself is a payoff. It would be worth doing just for that reason. But just keep in mind that you also have a lot more energy that you have temporarily stored in the form of an NADH, a reduced coenzyme. The other thing we should look at is what's happening to the carbon skeleton. Glucose is a hexose, right? Meaning it's a 6-carbon sugar. That's why it's just represented simply as 6 gray atoms, glucose. 6 carbons. Well, glycolysis is a splitting, and so we're partially dissembling the carbon skeleton in glycolysis. We're not completely dismantling it. To completely dismantle it, you'll have to go through the other process, which is cellular respiration. And when you completely dismantle it, all you'll have left, remember, are single carbon particles, carbon dioxide molecules. So you'll have 6 of those eventually. But glycolysis only goes partway toward the dismantling of the carbon skeleton. So you break 1 hexose into 2 trioses. Now, triose is another general word. It simply means a 3-carbon sugar. Pyruvate is an example of a triose. But it is the triose that gets produced at the end of glycolysis. It's not directly occurring, though. When you split 1 glucose into 2 3-carbon compounds, it's not pyruvate yet. There's a lot of moving things around within the molecule that happens, which is why it's a 10-step process. So you first have to manipulate things before you can even split the carbon skeleton. Those are the transactions that occur for the energy investment phase. And that involves phosphorylating from 2 different ATP molecules. Then you split it into 2 3-carbon compounds, which are not yet pyruvate. And then in the energy payoff phase, you manipulate those 3-carbon compounds so that you can get usable energy back out of them to make the 4 ATP that gets spit out of glycolysis. That's what puts you ahead ATP-wise. But in that, as part of that energy payoff phase, you also end up making a couple you reduce two NAD pluses into NADH and H plus. Okay? Let's look at the whole pathway now in slide 8. So as I define it in two major phases, energy investment and energy payoff, the whole top part of this is the energy investment phase. And then everything else is energy payoff. But what this book is calling phase two is simply the part of the energy payoff phase that involves reduction of NAD plus into NADH. Okay? Phase three is just the second half of the energy payoff phase, in other words, where you make even more ATP, but you don't reduce any more coenzyme. That's because it's not oxidative. The oxidative part is what allows you to reduce NAD plus, right? Because you can't have oxidation only. You can't have reduction only. It's a redox reaction, a reduction oxidation reaction, meaning something is going to be reduced and something else has to be oxidized for that to happen. Because you don't just eliminate, you don't destroy electrons, right? You transfer them. So it's the fuel that is being oxidized, but that allows you to then reduce the coenzyme, thereby investing it with some of the energy that was in that fuel molecule. But there's a little bit of loss of heat at every one of these transactions, and you can't do anything about that. Okay, so let's just quickly look at what's happening here in this energy payoff or energy investment phase. You start off with glucose, and like I said, the first thing that you do is phosphorylate that glucose. That's why you need an ATP immediately in this energy investment phase. The ATP is the source of the phosphate that you're going to stick onto the glucose to make it glucose 6-phosphate. Why is it called glucose 6-phosphate? Simply because the phosphate gets stuck onto the part of the skeleton featuring the sixth carbon in the skeleton, the last one. All right, so that once you have glucose 6-phosphate, it gets converted into fructose 6-phosphate. Well, what are glucose and fructose with respect to each other? They are isomers, right? They're both hexoses. They have exactly the same chemical formula. They're just a different arrangement of atoms. So that's what happens here. Notice that each of these enzymes gets a gly and a number, meaning glycolysis, enzyme number 1, enzyme number 2, and so on, and they're listed here. Well, what is gly 2? Phosphoglucoisomerase. In other words, it takes phosphoglucose, which is glucose 6-phosphate, a glucose with a phosphate on it already, and turns it into an isomer. So it doesn't split, it doesn't dismantle the carbon skeleton at all, it just rearranges it. And it still has a phosphate on it, so it's now fructose 6-phosphate. What changes is the double bond position at the top, notice. That then it gets phosphorylated again, which is the second reason why you need ATP in the energy investment phase. The second ATP that you're spending on this original one glucose molecule is put into phosphorylating fructose 6-phosphate at the 1 position, and that's why it turns it into fructose 1,6 bisphosphate. Bi and bis mean the same thing. They both mean 2. So it's a doubly phosphorylated fuel molecule at this point. A doubly phosphorylated hexose. And now you can, now that it's doubly phosphorylated and therefore an activated fuel, you can go through with the dismantling process, which is to split the hexose into 2 trioses. Now, at the fork of the road here, notice that there's 2 possibilities, as you would expect for a fork in the road. Instead, there's 2 ways to go here, 2 possibilities. Notice that one of them is dihydroxyacetone phosphate, the one in the upper right. The other is glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. the enzyme to do that, GLI4 here, aldolase, it is equally likely to make either one of these two products. And so both of them get formed in the cell, but only one of those two, specifically glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, or G3P as it's often abbreviated, is able to feed the rest of the process. It's the only one of the two possible products of the dismantling that's able to go on to the next step. Which means you would have to either waste half of your fuel by throwing away the dihydroxyacetone phosphate, or you need a way to convert it into the other possible product, G3P. And of course, the latter is what really happens. You don't waste the fuel. GLI5, triose phosphate isomerase, does exactly what that name tells you it's going to do. It takes a triose phosphate, which is dihydroxyacetone phosphate. It's a phosphorylated 3-carbon sugar, a triose phosphate. And it isomerizes it into the other version, glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. So even though they're both made, what you end up with effectively are two glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate molecules made from what was originally one glucose. So that, which is the end of the energy investment phase, that is where you, the only place where you dismantle the skeleton. There's only one break in the skeleton in terms of number of carbons, and that's why you go from one molecule originally to 2-3 carbons. This, by the way, is why all of the accounting, numbers of ATPs, numbers of NADH, are doubled beyond this point. Because when you do it on a per glucose basis, you're going to have to multiply everything by 2, starting with glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, because you produce 2 of those from that one glucose. This is showing you what happens to one of them, but it happens simultaneously to 2 different ones going down the same pathway. And so you end up making 2 NADHs in this step. And notice what the name of that GLI6 is. Glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, the substrate that it works on, dehydrogenase. It picks hydrogens off of that fuel. 2 electrons, 2 protons get added to NAD+. Well, 2 electrons and 1 proton get added to NAD+ to make it NADH. Plus you have an extra proton. NADH plus H+. That's carrying a lot of energy. After that, you're done with oxidation. And it's really just a rearrangement of the carbon skeleton, what's stuck to that carbon skeleton. But it's a rearrangement that's energetically beneficial to the cell because it allows, in 2 places, ADP to pick up a phosphate, turning it into ATP. So the energy payoff exists not only as reduction of NADH, or reduction of NAD plus into NADH, but phosphorylation of ADP into ATP. Now notice that you put those phosphates onto the fuel originally, but then you get them back, sticking them onto ADPs. All right? And everything is doubled from here onward, so the net energetic gain is 2 NADHs and 2 ATPs for the net gain, because 2 of those you had to pay originally. Okay, so if that's all you're doing with a glucose molecule is glycolysis, and you're not going on to cellular respiration because you can't for whatever reason, then that's all you get from that fuel. In terms of usable energy, you get 2 ATP. The NADH isn't as versatile, like I said. It has to be dealt with in a different way. And so we'll talk about that next time.